Hello there, and welcome to Gilded in Blood, the Horror Lit Podcast. My name is Kevin, and ladies and gentlemen, happy Halloween. It is finally here. It is the day of spooks and scares, and I am here to give you my top 20 horror movie list of all time. We've gone through 80 movies that I feel that every horror fan should definitely check out. They've been in no particular order, just movies that you need to see. Put on your list if you haven't seen them, but this is my top 20. This, to me, is the best of the best that horror movies have to offer. I've said it a couple of times before in these episodes. I feel like anybody who purports to have any sort of expertise in horror, even if they're just a big old fan like me, though I'm also a practitioner in the written word, I feel like everybody who has anything to say about horror needs to have, at the very least, a top 10 horror movie list, but I couldn't do it. Top 10 is too few movies. I have to give you my top 20, so that's what we're here to do today. I'm going to actually do this in a countdown format. We're going to start at number 20 and move down until we hit what I feel is the best of the best that horror movies have to offer, my absolute favorite horror movie of all time, and, by the way, also just my favorite movie all around of all time. So we're going to get to that, but we're going to start with number 20 at the top of the list, and that is going to be The Woman in Black from 2012, starring Daniel Radcliffe and directed by James Watkins. This is actually not the first adaptation of the Susan Hill novel, The Woman in Black. There was another one previous, filmed back in the 80s. This one is a little bit more updated, though it keeps the same time format. It's still in the 19th century, and it tells the story of an executor who goes to a place called Eel Marsh House to go through the papers of this woman who has died in this creepy mansion, and of course, supernatural hijinks ensue. Now, I am a huge, huge fan of ghost stories, ghost movies. I just absolutely love them, but they tend to be a little bit neutered. They tend to be a little run-of-the-mill. Things happen that you've seen in 10,000 other movies, and they get to be a tiny bit boring. This one really knocked off my socks. This one did some scares that I really wasn't expecting. I had not read the novel before I saw the movie, and I was completely unprepared for some of the more unique aspects that are going on here, one of which is that whoever sees the spectral figure of the woman in black doesn't themselves incur any sort of curse or any sort of damage or danger. Instead, children die throughout this town that Eel Marsh House is next to. So the people of this town are desperate to keep people away from the house because if there is a sighting, some of their children may be in grave danger. So this also becomes a bit of a murder mystery. Something's going on here and something needs to be solved to take care of whatever this curse is. It's just so unique. It's something that I'd never seen before. Also, the setting is excellent. The mansion, the big house is out on this secluded piece of land in the moors, and during high tide, the road that goes to the house is actually submerged. You can't get away. So once you're there, for a certain period of time, you are stuck. You are trapped here at Eel Marsh House. Quite a few jump scares to this one, so if jump scares kind of turn you off, you might want to avoid this one, but it is deliciously creepy. It's so good at what it does. It's probably one of the best, which is why it's on this list. 2012's The Woman in Black. All right, next up on our list of 20 is Godzilla, or as it was called in Japan, Gojira, from 1954. All right, this one was directed by Ishiro Honda, who later would go on to do some others in the franchise, but this one is the only one, until we kind of hit the new legendary movies that become way over-serious and maybe a little little hammy. This was the only one that was really actually serious. This was a movie that Honda intended to help the people of Japan deal with the fact that they were the only people, and still remain, and let's keep it that way forever, please, everybody. They remain the only country, the only place that has ever experienced the brunt of nuclear weapons. So this was his way of trying to externalize that trauma, that horror and dread, in a way that people might be able to relate to a little bit more, but that was not so close and terrifying. I mean, 1954, they're not even a decade removed from what happened in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So these wounds are still very, very fresh. So he decided to come up with this idea of this monster, this mutated thing that comes out of the ocean as a direct result of nuclear weaponry. The movie starts with a ship out on the ocean being buffeted by nuclear winds, and these people have radiation burns and are sick and everything like that. That is a direct reference to an actual historical event when America was testing their thermonuclear weapons. These would be hydrogen bombs rather than atom bombs. They tested it on a small Pacific island and radioed to everybody, okay, we're going to be testing this island. You need to give us this radius of clearance so that you're not in the blast zone. Well, they had no conception of how powerful this nuclear explosion would be. So there was a Japanese trawler called, ironically, the Lucky Dragon, that was in the vicinity of the blast, outside of the vicinity of the reported blast zone, but certainly within the vicinity of the actual blast zone, and it got covered in radiation. Those sailors were sick. It was just terrifying. And this, even after they had to deal with the effects of the A-bombs being dropped in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So there was a lot of cultural angst going on at this time, and Honda really captures this in this movie about this giant monster that's coming out of the ocean because of nuclear warfare and nuclear weaponry and misuse. There's a lot to say about pacifism. The doctor in the movie who has a possible weapon to fight Godzilla with does not want it used, because if he uses it against Godzilla, the government will take it and possibly use it against other humans. So there's these concepts of what is the proper weaponry to use in war, where is their humanity in wartime. But there's also really disturbing references to the actual events of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There are scenes where Japanese people are running around, and it will focus in on somebody and says, oh man, we've got to go down into the shelters again. Or there's a really heartbreaking scene where there's this woman and her two kids in a building that's being knocked down by Godzilla, and she's holding her children to herself and saying, don't worry, we'll be with your father soon. Assuming probably that their father was killed in the blasts at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So there's really some hard stuff to watch here. And interestingly enough, when America acquired the film, maybe a little bit of a guilty conscience here, they cut those scenes out, or they left those untranslated. So it's a really interesting film to watch in terms of the historical aspect, but as far as a giant monster movie goes, for a guy in a latex suit, it's actually done very well. The first scene of Godzilla coming up over the mountain is a little creepy. It's a little scary. It's actually a very, very well done movie. But in terms of the historical aspect of it, in terms of what it's trying to say and how it's trying to help an entire nation of people deal with what has been done to them, it's just an absolute masterpiece. You need to go see this. If all you've seen are kind of the goofy, stupid, kung fu-y ones that have come after, you owe it to yourself to go back to the source and to watch the original 1954 Godzilla, not the American one, the King of Monsters or whatever. Go see the actual Japanese one. It is really worth your time. All right, up next is 2015's The Witch, directed by Robert Eggers. And this movie, on the scale of disturbing, tops out maybe at an 11. It's very, very wonderful movie. It talks about this family that has been basically ostracized in the early 1600s from a New England town because of their religious differences, and they decide to go off and live on their own on the edge of this massive forest and quickly learn that there is somebody or something living in the forest. And the very first inkling that they get of that is there's a scene where the young daughter, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, is playing peekaboo with the baby of the family, and between one cover of her eyes and then peekaboo, there's the baby laughing, giggling, and then she covers her eyes and says peekaboo, and the baby's gone. It's really, really creepy. It's a very, very effective movie. Now, Robert Eggers is notorious now. He's having done, I think, three movies to his name, The Witch, The Lighthouse, which is a really good movie, much weirder than The Witch, and The Northman, which he wrote with Sion, who is an Icelandic poet and author. And he is really, really devoted to historical accuracy. This movie was actually based on accounts from the time, and it uses people speak in the dialect of the time. So it's not the easiest movie to understand. The second time I watched it, I decided, okay, I'm just going to live with it. This movie is in English. I should be able to understand it, but I'm going to put on the subtitles. And it was a dramatic difference. So I would suggest watching it with subtitles. It's in English. It is. It's in modern English, but it's hard to understand. Just the accents and the colloquialisms and the archaic language, it does help to put on the subtitles on this. But which movies always go toward the corny and the kooky and the stupid? I'm sorry, they just do. There are not very many good witch movies out there. They always tend to go for the over-the-top, the cackling and all sorts of things like that. This is, in my mind, the witch movie. This is the perfect movie featuring a witch. It's wonderful in that regard, but it's also excellent at showing how puritanical religious beliefs chewed up the people who believed them. There's so much suspicion within this family. There's a lot to talk about with the maturing of the girl in the family and how the parents try to reconcile that with their staunch conservative religious beliefs. There's so much going on in this movie, and always at the outset, there's that external threat of this presence in the woods that is making life difficult for them. It really is an absolutely wonderful movie, a spellbinding movie, and one that really slots in with this season perfectly. This is a perfect Halloween movie, so if you've never seen it, go check out The Witch. All right, for all you Lovecraft fans out there who have just pined away for a really good Lovecraftian movie. Yes, you have The Reanimator, which is fun, but let's say it, it's frankly stupid. I mean, let's be honest. It's a lot of fun, and parts of it are very scary and gory and fun and everything, but it's dumb. It's a really, really dumb film. If you're looking for the perfect Lovecraft adaptation, you have it. In 2019's Color Out of Space, directed by Richard Stanley and starring Nicolas Cage, Jolie Richardson, Elliot Knight, Madeline Arthur, Brendan Meyer, Karanka Kilcher, and, of all people, Tommy Chong. And it doesn't break the movie that he's in it. It actually works really, really well. If you've never read The Color Out of Space, first of all, expect that it will show up on the podcast eventually as a short shock. It's a wonderful short story. But a family living out kind of in the woods starts to be affected by something that comes down in a meteor and lands on their property. So that's all that I really need to say about that. I love this short story. It's one of my favorites of Lovecraft's, and I never thought that anybody would be able to tackle it in a way that wasn't goofy and corny and stupid. And Richard Stanley keeps a straight face pretty much the entire time. Yes, you have some trademark Nicolas Cage freakouts. That's fine, whatever, but they actually work organically within the movie. But the way that Richard Stanley starts to deal with the color, that's the only way that you can describe whatever is in this meteor. It starts to go out and infect the land with this color that nobody can quite put their finger on. It's just visually gorgeous. It's a lovely, lovely film. It's really spooky. It's very disturbing at points. And I think it's the perfect Lovecraft adaptation. He was all set to do another couple of adaptations of Lovecraft stuff, the primary one being the Dunwich Horror. Don't know if that's ever going to happen now. He got embroiled with some scandal, some mental abuse thing with a previous girlfriend. I don't even know where that's headed right now, but the movie company, maybe a bit prematurely, I mean, all there was one allegation and they just dropped his ass. There was just no more movie, not at all. No trial, no verification, which is, you know, that's another topic for another day, but he got dropped on that, so don't know if those other adaptations are going to happen, but we did get this one. We got Color Out of Space, which is an absolutely wonderful movie. If you are a Lovecraft fan and you've not seen this, make it the first thing you do come Halloween. Okay, if you remember the name Ari Aster from when we talked about his second movie, Midsommar, and I said you'd be hearing that name again, well, here it is. This is his film debut, Hereditary, from 2018, directed by Ari Aster, starring Toni Collette, Alex Wolff, Millie Shapiro, and Gabriel Byrne. These people are a family who matriarch has passed away. This is Annie, the Toni Collette's mother, has passed away at the beginning of the movie, and things start to happen within the film, and they are all related to the matriarch of this family who has died, but she is still very much with them. I really don't want to give too much away on this one. It really works well, kind of unfolding as you watch it. There's a lot of confusion at the beginning about what exactly is happening, why it's happening, and what all of this stuff means. But as the movie goes on, it does give you an answer, and it's really, really disturbing. It's one of the best horror movies of all time. Beyond my personal opinion, you can see it in top lists of people whose job it is to focus on movies. Critics love this movie. Toni Collette does such an amazing job in this movie, and it was, in my mind, an absolute crime that she wasn't even nominated for Best Actress in the Oscars. She won so many awards for this part, and Hereditary got completely ignored by the Oscars. That is a common theme with the Oscars. They do not recognize horror as a legitimate genre at all. To the Oscars, horror is throwaway, with some very small, minor instances, but it was completely ignored by the Oscars, but that does not mean it's not good. It's absolutely wonderful. If you basically ask anybody else, they'll say, it's a great movie. Even people who didn't necessarily like the movie will admit that it's wonderfully made. There are scares there. It's not your typical type of horror movie. It's a little bit convoluted. That's a little bit of a slow burn, and that's okay. I hope people who enjoy horror will build up that resistance to, I need a scare a minute kind of situation. That's not really what this movie is trying to do, but the implications of what happens in this movie and what it means and how these people have no hope from the beginning and why that's true. It's just a fascinating movie. If you've not seen Hereditary, please, please. This is one of the reasons that people say that we're living in a horror golden age, because of movies like this. So you need to go check out Hereditary. All right, enough of the serious horror movies. Let's go into some horror comedies, because I love, absolutely adore horror comedies, if they're done really well, and you're going to find a couple of them here at the top of my list. The first one being 1985's The Return of the Living Dead, directed by Dan O'Bannon and starring Clu Gulager, James Caron, Tom Matthews, and Don Calfa, in addition to some other wonderful, wonderful actors and actresses of the time. This is a very interesting story. I'm not going to go too far into it. I've mentioned the guys on the Horror Show before, another podcast that you guys need to be listening to. They did a complete episode over The Return of the Living Dead. I really highly suggest you go check that story out, because they do tell the backstory of all of this. The person who helped write this was actually somebody who worked with George Romero on Night of the Living Dead, and they kind of split ways, and they both took with them the ability to create sequels to Night of the Living Dead. So this is his version of the sequel. So, and the story is a bit convoluted, so I won't go too much into the plot summary, but a person at a medical supply company is training a young kid to work there and says that they have some of the actual zombies from the Night of the Living Dead. The things that happened in the story of the Night of the Living Dead, those were actually true, and they actually have some of the corpses. So they go down and look at those. One of the canisters breaks open. It spews this noxious gas into the air. These people get sick, but the cadaver they have in their storage unit starts to come alive. So to take care of this cadaver, they go across the street to a mortuary where the friend of the person who runs the medical supply company works, and they get him to cremate this alive body, dead alive body, I guess you would say. The smoke goes up, it rains down onto a cemetery, and the zombie apocalypse occurs. It's it's a really, really goofy movie. I've got to give it that much right off the bat. It's really, really goofy. There's the subplot with this group of punks that are waiting for the guy who's being trained in the medical supply company to get off work so they can go party or whatever, and they get caught up in this. And as goofy as it is, though, it is grim. It does not pull any punches. These zombies want their brains, and they are willing to bite into people's heads like apples, spraying blood everywhere. It's a grotesque movie. It really is. But if you're a horror fan, that's probably what you're kind of here for. It's a wonderful movie. It's a lot of fun. It hits the ground at about 60 miles an hour and never slows down. It's a spectacular movie to watch around this time of year. So if you're looking for something that maybe not is quite as heavy, not as intellectually difficult as things like The Witch or Hereditary, if you're just looking for a damn good time and a kick-ass zombie movie, this is your pick. There's no movie better than The Return of the Living Dead. Just looked at the time here. This is going to be a long episode. Sorry. Talking about 20 of my favorite horror movies, it's just going to take a while. So hopefully you're here for the whole ride. I'm having a lot of fun. Hopefully you're having a lot of fun too. Now we're going to keep the horror comedy train rolling with 2004's Shaun of the Dead, directed by Edgar Wright, starring Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. This is the first of the three movies that these three guys made together. It was Shaun of the Dead, it was Hot Fuzz, and The World's End. And they each were going to make fun of, or kind of do a send-up of a specific type of movie. The World's End would be the not really post-apocalyptic, but the getting there apocalyptic science fiction story. Hot Fuzz would be a buddy cop movie, and Shaun of the Dead, the first one they made, was a send-up of the zombie apocalypse movie. So it's fitting that it comes after Return of the Living Dead. There's no way to explain this movie to you and really even get close to exactly how clever, how smart, how god-awfully funny it really is. You just have to see it for yourself. I could spend an entire hour talking about this movie, about all the things they do in this movie. They're so genius. There's a great segment at the beginning of the movie. Shaun, played by Simon Pegg, is this kind of loser. He works at a dead-end job. He's about to be dumped by his girlfriend because he hangs out with his even more losery friend, played by Nick Frost, at the pubs every night. And there's this wonderful sequence, this tracking shot that goes for minutes on end, walking from his house to the store on the corner, and then getting some drinks, and then coming back. And one night, the zombie apocalypse just happens, and he is so out of it that he doesn't even recognize it. And you see that exact same shot, the exact same beats, but he is so lost in what he's thinking about, he does not recognize that all of the people that he interacted with that first time, he interacts with in almost exactly the same way the second time, yet now they are dead. It's Absolutely. It's one of the most hilarious things I've ever seen in my entire life. There's callbacks to every famous zombie movie. There's meta humor in it. There is one of the finest uses of a Queen song I have ever seen in my entire life. Watch it and you will understand. But if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. This is maybe the best horror comedy of all time. Shaun of the Dead, go check this movie out. And it is a wonderful one to watch around Halloween. You're going to love it, I promise. All right. You will have heard me talk about twofers, movies that go together at a couple of other times throughout this list. This one belongs on my top list. I think it belongs on everybody's top list. This is the duo of 1980s Stanley Kubrick's movie The Shining, starring Jack Nicholson, and 2019's Dr. Sleep, directed by Mike Flanagan and starring Ewan McGregor as Danny Torrance grown up. This is just my opinion, but it's also a simple fact. These two movies must be seen together. They just have to be. It's such a good pairing. Now, Stephen King did write the sequel, Dr. Sleep, so many years after writing The Shining, which, of course, is one of his best novels of all time. We will talk about it on the podcast eventually. It's in the 100 best horror books of all time. But the movie that Stanley Kubrick made, Stephen King famously hated it. And to be fair, he had a point. The novel is absolute, pure, undistilled terror, and Stanley Kubrick's movie is not the same. It's not the same. There is a way different feel to that movie than Stephen King's book. And the ending in particular is not the ending from the book. In the ending to the movie, Jack Torrance gets lost in the hedge maze, freezes to death, and the hotel is still standing. Spoiler alert for the book, the Overlook Hotel burns to the ground after the boiler explodes. So we're left with some very differing situations here. So Mike Flanagan had an absolutely monumental task going into adapting Dr. Sleep, because the ending of The Shining in the book and the ending of The Shining in the movie were two different things. So he had to ask himself the question, which are people really going to be thinking of? Are they going to be thinking of the ending of the book? Or are they going to be thinking of the ending of the massively famous, notorious movie, The Shining? And he figured they're probably going to be thinking about the movie. So he pulls one of the best magic tricks of all time and reconciles the ending of the book and the ending of the original movie at the ending of Dr. Sleep. He pulls it all together. Now, for any of this to make sense, you have a lot of work to do. I'm sorry. Those of you who've already done the work, you know exactly what I mean. But if you don't know what I'm talking about, here's your assignment. Go read The Shining. You should have done that by now. Seriously. Then go read Dr. Sleep. Then watch The Shining, and then watch Dr. Sleep. If you can get it, the director's cut. It's a better movie. It's like 3 hours long, but it's really, really good. Once you do all that, you will appreciate what Flanagan does in his movie. Not only creates a wonderful adaptation of the book, but actually rehabs even Stephen King's feeling towards the original movie. Stephen King was interviewed afterwards after seeing Mike Flanagan's movie and said, it actually made me like the Stanley Kubrick movie more than I do. And he has famously hated the movie. So it's a really, really interesting situation. But one of the most famous haunted hotels, this story of The Shining, is these three people, Jack, Wendy, and Danny Torrance, this married couple and their son, go up to the hotel. The son has some powers that the hotel wants because it is a place of psychic sickness, and it's just one of the best haunted hotels of all time. And Dr. Sleep tells the story of Danny Torrance grown up and addicted to drugs and alcohol in his adult life, and how he must help somebody else from a different kind of threat, a group of people who call themselves the True Knot, who feed on people with the Shining or the power that Danny has, because he's not the only one. If you have not seen any of this stuff, you really, really do need to clear an entire week of your schedule. Read these books, watch these movies. Guaranteed, you will like love them if you're a horror fan. I feel like everybody's already seen The Shining. I feel like fewer people have seen Dr. Sleep. Watch them both together. If you've seen The Shining already, watch it again and then watch Dr. Sleep. You will be impressed at the artistry on display in both of those movies. All right, sticking with ghosts, let's talk about 1982's Poltergeist, directed by Tobe Hooper and written by Steven Spielberg, starring Jo Beth Williams, Craig T. Nelson, Beatrice Straight. This is another movie that I feel like I don't really need to talk too much about. This is a suburban household, perfect 1980s representation of the nuclear family who start to experience odd happenings in their house. And the reason behind this, they find out exactly why. This is one of those movies that I feel has been on TV so many times that it almost feels like you would have needed to intentionally miss it to have not seen it by now. It's a movie kind of like The Wizard of Oz or It's a Wonderful Life. If you haven't seen it, you've probably gone out of your way for that to have happened. If you've not seen Poltergeist, I don't know why you're even listening to this. You must not enjoy horror at all. Poltergeist is a perfect movie. I can't come up with any negatives about this movie. It's just a classic. It's such a good capturing of how a family works. It's such a good capturing of how the 80s was, and even a little bit of commentary on the 80s about how this thought process of Reagan-era economics really impacted how people thought and even their moral decisions, and which is why maybe these people are being beset as they are. It talks a little bit about how spirituality was examined and thought of at the time. And it's a perfect movie. I can't think of anything bad to say about it. It's wonderful. It's so good. It is, by turns, funny, heartwarming, heartbreaking, scary as hell. It just genius, smart. It's everything. It's so, so good. You have to see this movie. And if you've already seen this movie, and I say this about a lot of the movies on this list, watch it again. See how well it holds up. This is a movie that my family and I watch regularly, maybe once or twice a year. It's just that damn good. Go check out Poltergeist. All right, time for the controversial entry on my list. This is 2020's The Empty Man, directed by David Pryor. Okay, talk about a backstory. This one has a doozy, so buckle up. This movie was produced under 20th Century Fox. This was the last film that they made before they were acquired and they became 20th Century Studios. Now, this movie was never going to be a run-of-the-mill normal horror movie. This movie was always going to be a bit of an outsider. David Pryor was given a lot of free rein to do some different things in this movie, and he did them. He did so many things that are very, very different than any other horror movie you've ever seen. The movie starts with this, as I remember it, it might be 10, 15, even 20 minutes long, little mini movie, almost like a short, before The Empty Man actually comes up on screen. And it's all backstory about what's going to happen in the story. And the story seems to be a fairly typical kids are committing suicide. There's a private investigator who's trying to figure out what's going on, but it seems to be wrapped up in this doomsday cult and everything. But nothing that you see really hints at what is actually going on under the surface and what happens at the end and how it ties in to that little mini movie at the beginning, which I do not even want to tell you anything about because it's so much more fun to go into it blind. Now, a little bit of a personal story on this. My family, my wife and my son and I love watching horror movies of all kinds, but some of the most fun are bad horror movies. Anybody out there who has never heard of Mystery Science Theater 3000, shame on you. Go check that out immediately. But those of you who have heard about it, I'm pretty sure that most of you have. That's one of our favorite shows to ever watch. So we love to kind of do that to bad horror movies. It's not quite as structured as those guys do it, but it's fun to kind of pick apart bad movies. So one of the movies that we did that to is a terrible movie called The Bye Bye Man. It's just a steaming pile of crap. It really, really is. So when we watched the trailer for The Empty Man, which even the name kind of sounds like The Bye Bye Man, the movie looked almost exactly the same. The movie looked terrible. It looked like it was going to be absolutely god-awful. So we were like, oh, this is going to be so much fun. We went out to, a Redbox. We grabbed a copy of it. We put it in, and we are ready to rip this one a new one. And then this little short happens, and it's dead serious, and it's really scary, and it's very, very unnerving and disturbing and very mysterious, and it makes us ask questions like, what the hell is going on, and why is this happening? And as the movie goes on, my son actually paused the movie and looked up to me and said, dang it, we wanted a bad movie, and this is a really good movie. We got hoodwinked. And there is actually precedence for that. Because the studio was taken over with this thing still in post-production, they had no idea what to do with it. They didn't know how to market it. They didn't know how to sell it to anybody. So instead, they just didn't. The trailer for this movie was made a week before it came out. That's unheard of. There's a level of not giving a shit that that speaks to that is absolutely astronomical. They dumped it in theaters. I think it was in theaters for like a week. They yanked it and they threw it on streaming and they completely forgot about it. As of today, there is no plan for a physical release of this movie. You have to go find it on streaming. However, thanks to a few people, one of the biggest champions for it is Chris Stuckman, who has a YouTube movie review channel who you need to check out. His opinions are usually spot on. Because of people championing this movie and saying this movie got the one of the rawest deals in all of cinema history, this movie has become this cult classic, this movie that people are trying to seek out. Check it out. Do not watch the trailer. I have never seen a trailer less representative of what the actual movie is. This movie is excellent. It is a work of genius. I will die on that hill. It is a genius movie. And I and my son happen to think it's Lovecraftian. Go watch it. See if you agree with that or not. But it is so good. It's one of the best horror movies ever. You need to check out The Empty Man. It's going to be hard to find. Make sure you catch it before they kick it off of streaming and it's impossible to find forever. Go check out The Empty Man. I promise you, it is worth your while. All right. From a controversial entry to one that I don't know that anybody can even argue with. This is the classic Halloween from 1978, directed by John Carpenter and starring Jamie Lee Curtis, Donald Pleasance, PJ Souls, Nancy Keyes. Again, don't know that I even need to talk about this. This is where Michael Myers got his start. After killing his sister when he was younger, being sent to a mental institution, so many years later, he escapes and comes back to Haddonfield and starts stalking these babysitters, the primary one being Jamie Lee Curtis. This is just the perfect horror movie. I've already said that about Poltergeist. I'll say it about some others that are coming up. I really will. But by now, this is so ingrained in the culture that I really don't even need to say anything else about it. All of the sequels are not as good. The second one's pretty good. The third one, not being a sequel to that story, being a completely different story whatsoever, it's still a lot of fun, but everything else from that point on, all of the other sequels, Rob Zombie's remakes, David Gordon Green's remakes, they're nothing. They're nothing compared to the original Halloween. You have to go check out Halloween. I don't think that I even need to say that to you, because if you're a horror fan, almost certainly you've seen Halloween. But if you don't watch this every single year during the month, Aw, you're missing out. This is the perfect way to just get your holiday started, get that month going. Go watch Halloween, John Carpenter's classic horror story. But you've not heard the last of John Carpenter's name. Trust me. Okay, another Japanese entry, 2001's Pulse, or in the Japanese, Cairo, directed by Kiyoshi Kurosawa. Another ghost story. I'm sorry, I just love me a good ghost movie, and this is really one of the best. This movie is set in what was then modern-day Tokyo and deals with technology. People trying to, this is 2001. People are a little bit wary about things like the internet and computers still, but this is a story about how ghosts, the afterlife, which is over-teeming with these ghosts, start to see the internet, the frequency of the internet, as a conduit, a way back to the land of the living. And it's just one of the most supremely creepy movies I have ever seen. It's just so damn scary. There's one sequence where a person encounters one of these spirits, and there's a great little YouTube video on there, the making of the scariest scene of movies or something like that. I can't remember the name of it, but if you type in Cairo and movie scene, you will probably find it. And he goes over exactly what makes this scene so frightening. There's differences in film speed. There's the way that it moves is incorrect. It's just so damn creepy. It's a wonderful, wonderful movie. I feel like not enough people have heard of this movie. By the way, if you end up watching the American remake with Kristen Bell, that's your own damn fault. Stay away from it. It's junk. It's trash. It's nowhere near as good or intelligent or just out and out scary as the original 2001 Japanese film. So be prepared to read some subtitles, but you are going to really be in for a treat if you go check out this movie. If you're in the mood to be creeped out and left creeped out for days afterwards, this is the movie for you, Pulse, or in the Japanese, Cairo. Okay, you knew it was going to be on this list somewhere, and here it is. It's 1999's The Blair Witch Project, directed by Daniel Myrick and Eduardo Sanchez, starring Heather Donahue, Michael C. Williams, and Joshua Leonard, a trio of film students who go out to investigate the story of the Blair Witch in Burkittsville, Maryland, and they disappear, and a year later, their footage is found, and the footage comprises the movie. I remember being really into the marketing of this movie. If you've never heard the story, it's really, really interesting. Go check out a documentary about it. Fascinating what these two directors did to market their movie. They treated it as real, as absolute fact. There were stories about these people's lives. The actress and the actors use their real names. They are, those are their real names, and those are their names in the story. In fact, they were not even invited to the debut of the movie so that the illusion would stay that these people are missing, that nobody knows what happened to them. It was absolute genius. And this was really when the internet was sort of getting up on its legs and running. So people would go to this website, see this missing poster, and really believe that these people were missing. This was going to be a real movie. Of course, it's not real, but just the way that it was shot, there was no script whatsoever. They were given direction in the form of, like, basically they would be out in the woods. They would find this little cache of food and water and some written out directions of, okay, then you need to go north by northwest for this many miles or so on and so forth. And then they just acted like they were lost in the woods. And then, of course, the directors were in the woods making sounds at night, making the little stick figures and hanging them outside their tents so that they would wake up in the morning not expecting it. It's just a genius movie and really is very, very terrifying with basically no special effects. It's all left up to the mind, left up to the imagination of the viewer, and it is terrifying. I was so lucky to be able to watch it opening night, midnight at a theater, and it scared the living bejesus out of me. It was so frightening. I loved it. I absolutely adored it. There are some people out there who bitch and moan, oh, it's not scary, it's just a shaky camera. Okay, then maybe you should stop watching horror movies. If you were not able to watch this movie and love it and be frightened by it, you need to go watch romantic comedies or something else. You are not here for horror. You're not a fan. I'm sorry. You're just not. If you can't appreciate the artistry of this movie, this horror is just not for you. This is wonderful, wonderful horror. One of the first found footage movies. Certainly not the first, but probably the one that got the biggest and spawned the rest of the found footage movement, none of which has been as good as this one. Go watch this again. If you've never seen it, go check it out. Be prepared for a little bit of a shaky camera. I mean, it's a handheld camera, but I think you'll be okay. But even if you've seen it before, go check it out again. It is a perfect cold fall weather movie. It makes you feel that way. It's a perfect movie to put on in this month of October and a wonderful one to end the season with on Halloween. Okay, we have a thriller on this list. I apologize. I'm sorry. But this movie does function as a horror movie, I promise you. This is 1995's Seven, starring Brad Pitt, Morgan Freeman, Gwyneth Paltrow, Kevin Spacey, and John C. McGinley, directed by David Fincher, and written by Andrew Kevin Walker. I say the writer's name because he deserves special mention for writing what, for a long time, was my favorite movie of all time. I saw this movie probably 20 or 30 times in the theater, and if that makes you think that I'm some sort of psychopath, I'm sorry. It's not because of the grisliness of the movie. It is the genius in its construction, how it is written, how everything works together. It's one of those movies that when you get to the end and you see how everything that you've just seen has been perfectly orchestrated by this serial killer, he had all of this in his mind when he started everything, and it worked all the way out perfectly how he created it. It's just a work of art. It really, really is. But in this work of art is some of the most foul, viscerally upsetting and disturbing set pieces I've ever seen. This, of course, follows two detectives who are hunting this killer who is killing people based on the seven deadly sins. Each murder is a different sin. The first murder is gluttony, and we see a morbidly obese person who has been tied, his hands and legs tied to this chair with barbed wire, which is very uncomfortable, and forced to eat until his stomach rips open and he dies. So one of these detectives is a very well-read, well-learned man who he knows exactly what's going on, and the one who is the younger one, who he is training to kind of take over this beat, he is not the same at all. He doesn't really know about any of this, so this older detective takes it upon himself to teach this younger detective what is actually going on. So this is a perfect example of what in the literature world is called reader response, that the person who goes into this text, and text can be used in the academic sense to be any form of information, whether it be a book, a short story, a movie, a TV show, anything. So when you come into the text knowing a little bit more about the subject, you're going to appreciate it in a different way. So Morgan Freeman's detective, who has read The Canterbury Tales, who has read Dante's Inferno, who has read all of these books, knows more about what's going on and can appreciate how best to go about catching this person somewhat more than Brad Pitt's younger detective, who has not read any of this. So it's a really interesting movie in that it's going to play differently according to what your level of learning is. It's certainly not looking down on people who haven't read any of this stuff. It has Morgan Freeman's character there to actually pull you through and to give you the necessary information. But if you have read these things, you are scared earlier than people who have not. So it's an interesting movie and it plays differently on that. But how everything works out in this movie is just this clockwork of absolute perfection. I can't say it any better. You really, really need to see Seven. Ladies and gentlemen, we are down to the final five movies of all time, according to me. So take that with a grain of salt. But number five is 1989's Pet Sematary, directed by Mary Lambert, starring Dale Midkiff, Denise Crosby, Blaise Berdahl, Fred Gwynn, and Miko Hughes as cute little Gage Creed. Is absolutely terrifying. Tells the story of a doctor, his wife, and his girl and his baby son who moved to this idyllic sort of town in Maine, but they are right on the highway where these big trucks are coming by. And their neighbor across the street tells them that up in the hills, there is a little pet cemetery where people have buried their pets because being killed in the road. And then when his daughter's cat is hit in the road and killed, the neighbor says, well, there's actually something else beyond that cemetery, and I will take you there. We'll bury your cat. And they do. And just like the rhyme, the cat comes back, but it's not the same cat. So that's pretty much where the story starts. Obviously, I don't think I need to tell anybody about this. If you've not seen this movie, you might have been living under a rock. That's probably true of most of these, certainly with these next top five. But please go check out this movie if you never have. And also, please avoid the remake. It is so, so boring. To me, any movie that is bad is allowed to be bad. It's perfectly fine for it to be bad. If it's poorly directed, poorly acted, the writing's off, whatever, fine, that's okay. The unforgivable sin for any movie is to be boring. God damn it, don't bore me. And that movie is so dull. It also changes the story in a way that could have been shocking, but they gave it up in the goddamn trailer. So please avoid the new Pet Sematary. It's really not worth your time. Stick with the original Mary Lambert's classic Pet Sematary. All right. Number four, you knew it was going to be here somewhere, and here it is. Jaws by Steven Spielberg, starring Roy Scheider, Richard Dreyfuss, and Robert Shaw. I love this movie. I love this movie so damn much. It's ridiculous how much I love this movie. I've seen this movie probably more times than there are fingers and toes in my entire family, extended even. I've seen this movie so many damn times, and every single time it comes on, my plans go out the window. I have to sit and continue watching this movie. I think it's just genius. It's such a good story. By now, all of the problems with the mechanical shark and how that made the movie better, all of those things are just kind of public knowledge. I don't really want to go over this again. You really do need to go listen to the Horror Show's episode over Jaws. They really do a good job going over it, and they love it, with the exception of one of them, which, by the way, come on, get on the train, man. It's just an excellent movie. But it is a wonderful example of the perfect use of suspense, the perfect use of different sets. It's almost like three different movies all put together, and it's so, so perfect. One of my most cherished memories is when we went out to visit my wife's aunt in California. She put us up in a hotel at one point that was actually on the beach. You would go out your front door, you would walk like 20 or 30 meters, and you are on the beach and you are in the water. And they had these windows that opened, and the sound and the smell of the sea would come in, and you could look out and you could see little lights on the boats out just in the dark of the ocean. And I turned on the TV as I'm laying there, and don't you know it, Jaws came on. It was glorious. I watched that whole thing, smelling the ocean and hearing the ocean and watching this wonderful, scary movie about a town that's beset by a great white shark. It's lovely. I love it. It's one of my favorite memories of all time. I've watched this movie probably too many times. I think you should watch it the same amount of times. It gets better every single time. Check out Jaws from Steven Spielberg, 1975, classic, wonderful, the first blockbuster of all time. And there's a reason. It's because it's a perfect damn movie. Go check it out. All right, number three is a classic, perhaps the classic, 1931's Frankenstein, directed by James Whale and starring, of course, Boris Karloff in the best role he'd ever done. Ever. Ever, ever, ever. Forever. It's just always going to be true. I love this story. I love the book, which, of course, we've already talked about. I love almost every single incarnation of it. Even Kenneth Branagh's really weird version of it. It's actually not a bad one. It's just very odd. But 1931's Frankenstein, to me, is just perfect horror. It's excellent. It's the best of the Universal monster movies, in my mind. It's just so damn good, and it has so much to say, and it says it so well. It is a movie that captures the perfect atmosphere of the stormy night, the mad scientist, the horror of the creation that he begets upon the world. It's just perfect, perfect cinema. And by the way, we have to have like an honorable mention here, which is Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein, which is a movie I love almost as much as this one. I love to watch them in tandem. There was such love put into Mel Brooks's movie, and to the point where he actually uses the same lab setup as Frankenstein, the same props. He found those and used them in his movies. Really one of the best Mel Brooks movies. But Frankenstein has been a perennial favorite of mine forever. For a while, I watched it every single October. It was the way I started my October. I really haven't done that in a while. There's just so many more movies to see. But I think I may start that back up. It's just, it's always good to remember where your roots are. And these are the roots of a lot of classic horror. It's wonderful. 1931's Frankenstein. Okay, number two, the penultimate choice here, is 1963's The Haunting, directed by Robert Wise. Okay, guys, you understand that I like ghost movies. This top 20 proves this to me. There is no better ghost story than The Haunting of Hill House. You know this to be a fact. You know that I know this to be a fact. This is the first book I ever covered on the podcast. There's a reason. I think it's perfect. I don't think there's anything that's even remotely better in terms of a ghost story than this one story. And the 1963 adaptation is just about perfect. It is creepy. It is absolutely scary. It's beautiful in the black and white. The sets are just enormous and off-putting and gorgeous in a creepy way. The scenes where there's hammering on the door and the door bends inward, which offends our knowledge of how physics should work and just really off-puts the viewer. It's such a good movie. The sound design, especially in this 1963 movie, is just genius. Turn it up, make it louder, and it will scare you more. There's so much going on in this movie that it's just, it's so, so good. Now, a couple of kind of satellite things. First of all, do not, I beg of you, do not watch 1999's The Haunting, the CGI bullshit mess of a movie that I own it. I'll freely admit that I own it so that I can laugh at it. It's one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my entire life. It looks terrible. It is so god awfully bad. Don't watch that one. Watch the 1963 one. Now, if you are going to watch another adaptation of it, though, I can't highly recommend enough Mike Flanagan's Netflix 10-part miniseries, The Haunting of Hill House, which does tell the story, but shifts a lot of the story in a way that initially I was very, very upset about. It was a lot like somebody just stomping on a Bible in front of me. How dare you mess with Shirley Jackson's perfection of a novel? But when I saw what he was trying to do and how so much love for the novel is actually in that, I really caught into it and really paid attention, and it remains one of the scariest, one of the best things I've ever seen on screen. The only reason it's not here in place of 1963's movie is that technically it's TV. So I think next year we might talk about horror in television for the October bonus, and I'm certainly saving that for then. But if, as far as movies go, The Haunting from 1963 is absolute perfection. It's such a good haunted house movie from one of the best haunted house books of all time. And here it is, ladies and gentlemen. This is it. Number one, the best horror movie of all time, according to me. And also, according to me, the best movie of all time. I love this movie so, so very much. I can't think of many things that would keep me from watching this movie if the opportunity arose. This is, to me, the perfect movie. I'm talking about 1982's John Carpenter's The Thing. A perfect movie. The perfect movie. Starring, among others, Kurt Russell, Wilford Brimley, David Clinton, Keith David, Richard Dysart, Charles Hannon, Richard Mauser, Donald Moffat, and just the list goes on. This group of scientists who are in this remote Antarctic outpost who one day see a Norwegian helicopter chasing a sled dog across the snow, trying to kill this dog. And after an errant bullet strikes one of their team, they kill the Norwegian team in self-defense. They take the dog into their camp, and they really should not have done that because that dog is not a dog. I adore this movie. I can't say enough good things about this movie. And honestly, I'm thinking about this. Coming up to this episode, I even started to think, really, do I like this more than The Haunting? Do I like this more than Jaws? Why? And I just think that the sense of paranoia that is created in this story, because once we figure out what the dog actually is, we can't trust anybody. And the idea that you can't trust anybody who you are trapped with, all of these people, there's no getting out of this situation. The way it's shot, the way it's written, the way it's acted is all pitch perfect. Everybody was on their A game on this movie. I can't imagine a movie being better than this movie. I hear that when they were shooting this movie, it was agreed among the actors that they would not decide that one person is the thing or is not. So much of the acting is, yes, you have to live with these people. You have to get along with these people. You have to help these people to fight whatever this thing is. But every single person is looking at every other person with this kind of half-lidded eye of, I don't know that I can trust you. I don't think you are who you are. And it's just such a good movie. The isolation of it, the coldness of it, the dark of it, everything about it is just utter perfection. I love this movie so much. I really hope that you have seen this movie, but if you have not seen this movie, you have to stop everything you're doing. You have to call in sick to work. You have to take your family and push them aside. You have to go watch this movie. This movie is the perfect movie. If you are into horror, if you are into science fiction, which there are people who might argue it's more science fiction than horror, bullshit. It is a horror movie. If you have any affinity for this genre at all, and you've not seen The Thing, I will reserve my hate for you and just put that aside for now. I'll yell at you later, but before I do that, go check it out. 1982's John Carpenter's best movie he ever made. Absolute, without a doubt, no close second, best movie ever made, The Thing. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That is my top 20 horror movies of all time. If I sounded like a stupid geeky fanboy, it's because when it comes to these movies, I am a stupid geeky fanboy. I love these movies so much. I have such sweet spots in my heart for these movies, and I think you will too. I think you probably do too, for most of them. I can't imagine that people who are listening to this haven't seen most, if not all of these. But if there's any that you're missing, make it your mission to go out and check them out. This is Halloween night. This is Halloween day. Whenever you're listening to this, you really should at least watch one of these movies today. But you know what? Not much is going on in November. Yeah, we got Thanksgiving, but that's fine. Christmas isn't going to start ramping up for a while. So go get some of these movies and have a spooky November, damn it. Watch these movies. These are such good movies. And then go check out the other 80 as well if you've not seen any of those. Check these movies out. These are kind of the best of the best when it comes to the horror genre on screen. Go take care of them.
Tomorrow we are back to our regularly scheduled programming, and we're going to have a full episode that is going to be Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None. That is a genre-busting beasts episode, so I'm going to spend my time convincing you that in addition to being a wonderful mystery novel, it's also one of the best horror books out there. So stay tuned for that. I think you'll really enjoy it.
Thanks to Swarm for the use of his music, now and always. You can find this podcast on any of the popular podcast platforms, or you can go right to the source and find it at gildedinblood.buzzsprout.com. Until next time, stay safe and stay spooked, and ladies and gentlemen, happy Halloween.